You're listening to Coming of Cage, a Nicolas Cage podcast.
Hello, and welcome back to the Coming of Cage podcast. Happy New Year. Welcome to 2024. I am Derek. And I have your other host, Ryan, right here with me.
Indeed you do.
Indeed. And we are here to talk Nicolas Cage movies, in particular the 1988 classic Vampire's Kiss.
Yes. Yeah. A big one for us. Both of our first viewings of this movie. But if you know anything about Nicolas Cage, then you know that this movie is kind of I don't know if I want to say the pinnacle, but it's definitely like the movie that people know him from without knowing what it is, because one of his like most popular meme faces is from this movie. So yeah, I mean, you've probably seen the meme even if you don't know what the movie is, but yeah, this is the one that people really bring up when they're talking about what Nick Cage means to them.
That's right. And the IMDb synopsis does not do this movie justice. According to IMDb, this movie is about a man who, quote, after an encounter with a neckbiter, a publishing executive thinks that he's turning into a vampire.
And just to like preface this, you know, when I'm saying that people are saying this movie is what like they idolize Cage for, I mean, this movie is batshit crazy. Calling it a movie seems generous to me, because it mostly just seems like a bunch of improvised Nick Cage scenes of the same character that they put together with something that might resemble a plot. I mean, barely. And I'm not trying to trash this movie, because I genuinely enjoyed watching every single second of this movie, but it is nuts. And whatever you've heard about this movie, if you haven't seen it, I mean, that whatever you heard and whatever we're telling you, it will not prepare you for the actual viewing experience of this movie. It has forever changed my perspective on movies and what movie executives will pay to make, and what Nick Cage as an actor is capable of, because I definitely think that this movie is like probably the most batshit crazy Nick Cage we're ever gonna see. And we don't say that lightly, because Derek has rated a movie a one before, and I said, Derek, we're only like 20 movies in, you probably want to, you know, leave the one, because there's probably gonna be worse. And you were like, no, there can't possibly be worse. And then sure as shit, we found some that were worse. And this movie, I'm going to just like say now, I'm pretty sure for both of us, it's going to be a 20 on the cage-o-meter.
On caginess.
Caginess, yeah.
Caginess, yeah. I mean, and spoilers though, this is not going to be my lowest rated Nicolas Cage.
No, I wouldn't imagine it would be. I can imagine a bunch of movies that you would. I wasn't saying this is a one.
Oh, okay.
I was saying that we don't give out like the extreme end of scores lightly anymore. Being 40
we've learned
movies
our lesson.
In.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. Yes. No, I think that's fair. I mean, a few.
This might be
note.
A long episode too, because I have a lot of notes and there's a lot of things to talk about in this movie.
Okay, well then, good. Then let's kick things off then. So for those who are just joining us for the first time, welcome. Thank you for checking us out. What an episode to begin with. And if this is your 41st episode listening to us, thank you for joining us for all these Nicolas Cage movies. Ryan here takes meticulous notes as he watches these movies. I snack on popcorn and goldfish. And then we go through Ryan's notes. So Ryan, indeed, please kick us off.
I do want to throw out a trigger warning. There is very briefly some things that we'll probably touch on that, you know, are not great, sexual assault related. So if that kind of thing is not great for you, you may want to not listen to this episode, even though we'll talk about it, but hopefully not in extreme detail or anything like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, yes. So my notes, yeah. Occasionally will be incomprehensible in the sense that, like, I write a note that makes sense in the moment, and then we try and decipher it and figure out what exactly that thing was.
I speak Ryan.
And there's a lot of moments in this movie where it's like, I don't know if my note will do justice to what the scene was, but we're going to start. Okay. My first note is cityscapes, because we get like 6 straight minutes of just like shots of the city.
Yeah. I mean, they really want you to know that this is in New York.
And it's not like that's not just isolated to the beginning of the movie.
No,
that's throughout the movie. We see a lot of city, and they did do a commentary of this movie, which I don't think is super common for Nick Cage to do commentaries for his movies. Maybe it is. I haven't looked into it as much, but he did in 1999 do a commentary for this movie with the director. And in that commentary, he did say something along the lines of that the city was kind of like its own character in the movie, and it was driving the main character crazy. And so throughout the movie, like, it's the city starts really blurry in the early movie, and then it gets sharper and more in focus throughout the movie, which seems like a message that I would have never taken away from this movie. So,
yeah. I didn't get that. Now, to be fair, he does claim that a lot was cut from this movie. Some of his best work was cut from this movie. So maybe that would have come through when we get the Nick Cage cut of Vampire's Kiss in a few years.
That probably won't happen if it hasn't come out yet, sadly. But
I mean, it just got released on Blu-ray last year. So this is where it's going to see like a resurgence.
Yeah. So apparently, according to the director, he said that the idea of the city driving Low crazy through its omnipresence, and he accomplished this by constantly featuring the buildings of NYC in frame. Early on, for example, he sits in the doctor's office with the city in soft focus behind him, but later, as he grows more insane, the city becomes clearer into view. He wanted to extend the movie beyond just a one-dimensional plane, which sounds like he was on a lot of cocaine and didn't quite understand the things he was saying. But
so, yeah, I mean, I will say, so I watched it on the Blu-ray. It wasn't like the sharpest transfer I've ever seen, and there were definitely some technical issues with the Blu-ray cut. So maybe if I had like a fully restored 4K release, I might have noticed those types of background changes, but I definitely missed all of that.
Yeah, it didn't really... Yeah, I don't really, I saw a little bit of that, but I didn't take it as what the director is implying it to be there.
Fair enough.
Yeah, so we get a shot, our first like introduction to Nick Cage is that he's in therapy. His character is in therapy. What's his character's name again? Peter Lowe. Yeah, Peter is in therapy, and which is good because he is insane.
Yeah.
Pretty, even in the beginning of the movie, he's insane, but he dives deeper into insanity throughout the movie. But yeah, even just in the beginning, he's insane, but he's in therapy for it. So that's good. But yeah, we get to hear the beginning of his weird accent.
What a weird accent
for this movie. So do you know the story behind the accent?
I don't know that I necessarily know the story behind it. I did notice that it was not quite consistent.
That's on purpose.
Okay.
Yeah. Allegedly, in a lot of the scenes where he's hallucinating or not hallucinating, he was differentiating that. He was like apparently Nick Cage was doing that on purpose to try and make a difference between when he was hallucinating and when he wasn't. I don't know how consistent that part is, but that's the explanation for it. But anyway, the actual accent, okay, his source for the accent was he kind of based it on his dad, apparently. And he said that it's kind of supposed to be like what he imagines a literary accent to be, like if you're an intellectual type of accent.
Okay, right, yeah, I could see that.
It's a little bit of a stretch, but I can definitely see where he was going with it for sure. Yeah, my next note is 80s dance club.
Yeah, I mean, that's where it opens us right up into a bar scene, people dancing, music going, drinks swinging, all around.
Yeah. And this is where he picks up the first girl he picks up in the movie.
Yes.
Which, I mean,
Jackie, I think.
Yeah. It's crazy in this movie. He is getting so laid constantly. Every woman, I will say this movie is very misogynistic.
Deeply.
It's like almost enough to be a theme of the movie as misogyny. And a lot of that stems from, you know, just the amount of women that want to bang Peter.
Yeah.
And he's got money. It's kind of implied in this movie. He's got a nice apartment, and this is in New York, right? So he's making money. He's working for a company that is just like agents for short stories, I guess.
It's publishing. They publish
people. Right, which apparently in the 80s was a lot of money, big money in that.
Well, I mean, there's just not as many publishers left anymore, right? But they were a publishing house. Yeah.
He has really nice suits all the time. He has like his own assistant. He's, you know, he's got a really nice apartment. And so, you know, it's implied that he has money, and maybe that's the message, is that women want money.
I don't know. Like, I guess we'd have to know more about what part of New York he lives in, 'cause that's like a studio apartment.
Okay, it's a nice apartment for New York. I mean, I think in 1988 money, he's doing pretty well for himself. Although there is a part later that where he appears to be broke, even though he seems pretty wealthy for the rest of the movie. In my opinion, apparently,
when was he broke? I'm missing that.
When he buys the vampire fangs.
Oh, right. Well, I think that's just because he shelled out cash for the cab.
And right. He didn't have enough cash and doesn't have any plastic. But So, yeah, he goes to this club and he finds this girl and they go home. And so there's a scene when he's like walking through the streets with her when they're going on the way to the house or the way to his apartment.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to hear the dialogue in the scene. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, yes. It was terrible. At this point, I had to turn closed caption. Did you turn
the top? So did you get the dialogue in the scene then?
Some of it.
He's talking to her about non-copyright versions of the Fantastic Four, basically.
Oh, I missed all of that part.
He's then describing like a rubber man and like a rock guy.
I guess I was too late to turn that on then. Okay.
Yeah, it's very weird. But then also, as far as like the behind the scenes of this movie, the reason that was so hard to hear was because they were a non-union shoot, and they had just right off camera a bunch of people protesting.
Yeah,
and the cops were there arresting them like at the time. That's the only way they could get it to be quiet. So they were trying to fight a lot of ambient noise there. And that's actually not that specifically, but a lot of this movie was filmed with people that didn't really know they were in the movie too.
Mm-hmm. You can kind of get that from some of the reactions of people that he walks funny. By later on.
But there's a lot of times when he's doing something outrageous and there's no reaction, which is hilariously New York to me. I've never even been to New York, but I know, from what I know about New York, that pretty much sums it up.
Yeah. Yeah. People kind of just ignore people.
Yeah. Yeah. So he takes the girl home and to his home, and they're kind of going at it. By the way, we did, since we have the weird accent, that is a space on our bingo card. So we got to hit that.
Yeah.
And then we get some nudity. So, which is another bingo spot for us. So we get that. And they're doing their deed and a bat flies in. And we get like a few seconds of bat cam where the cam is like following the POV of the bat.
That's which great. Is
a really bad, I don't want to say really bad because somebody put a lot of work into it, but like it doesn't move naturally.
It's a rubber bat.
It looks like somebody got a rubber bat almost like at a party store. It was just like shaking it up and down to make the wings flap.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want a fun fact about that?
Oh, please give me the fun fact about the bat. The
fun fact is that Nick Cage was very much method in this movie.
Yeah.
And he demanded a real bat be used in this scene. And so he actually at one point, apparently, this was in the commentary, sent his assistant to go find a bat in Central Park for him. And they didn't do it.
Find a wild bat. Go catch me a bat.
Go catch him a bat. He was crazy about this, apparently.
Wow.
And they didn't. The director talked him out of it because he said that the bat would bite him for real and he'd get rabies and die. And then Nick Cage gave up on it, apparently.
Well, I mean, coming full circle, in Pig, he got bit by the pig, and like he thought that's like that could have turned into like sepsis or something.
Yeah,
so, you know. Yeah, I mean, that's just kind of wild. Like they're gonna go catch a wild bat, not even like find a bat. Like,
can you imagine being that assistant? And like going home that night, and the wife is like, "Hey, what did you do at work today?" And you're like, "Well, Nicolas Cage sent me to Central Park to try and capture a live bat so that he could do a real method performance." And that was it. That was my day.
I mean, look, some assistants have to go get coffee.
If you're Nick Cage's assistant, apparently you go get bats. He did say in this commentary that he was a little off his rocker in this movie, which is kind of crazy to me because it's a pretty early movie for him. 88 wasn't like I feel like most actors wouldn't get the freedom to do what he was experimenting with in this movie until they were well established. And his biggest film at this point had been Moonstruck, which he was just coming off of.
But when you look at the director and the writer, he was established by comparison.
I mean, yes, but right? For a studio to put up money for this movie with that going on, I mean,
that's why it was non-union, I would imagine.
Probably.
Because nobody really wanted to shell out the money for this. I mean, like, when he trashes the apartment and, like, he's breaking the lamps and all the glass and stuff like that, like, that was all real. They had to do it in one take. They broke a camera in the process. Like, there's even more that we'll get into, right? But this movie is pretty bonkers.
Also, like, do you know what this movie was about? Like, what was the real plot of this movie?
I mean, I think so. I think the plot of the movie is that he has, like, a traumatic break when the bat comes in. And he has a mental breakdown where he thinks he is turning into a vampire, and he begins hallucinating this woman, Rachel, who he meets very briefly, but then continues to hallucinate is a real vampire, right? And he just goes mad.
So you think this is a movie about his slow descent into poor mental health, essentially?
Yeah, and I mean, it could have been caused by the job stress. It could have been caused by loneliness, and maybe that's why he keeps going after different women, because he's really very alone and he doesn't know how to make a connection. Because he has no friends.
You don't think that maybe he got bit by the bat when it came in, and this is the rabies slowly taking over his body?
I mean, maybe, but the movie never shows the bat really get anywhere near him.
No, but I mean, it doesn't show him not get bit either. I mean, he's wearing a Band-Aid for most of the movie.
But we see him get cut himself with the razor. He doesn't wear the Band-Aid till after that.
But also, yeah, that's true. But I mean, you still don't know if he got. I'm saying there's a lot of theories about this movie and what the plot actually is. And it's funny because in the commentary they did, Nick Cage says he likes that it's ambiguous and people can pick up their own thing from it. But the director says he had no idea what it was about.
Now, see, that's a problem. What are you doing directing a movie that you don't understand? You have the writer, don't you? Can't you ask the writer, hey, what did you mean by this? I mean, how do you put together a film if you don't understand it? Like, it's one thing if I don't understand it as a viewer. It's another thing if the people making it don't understand it.
Right.
Right. But I mean, to me, though, like, I'm not saying it's impossible that, like, it's a, you know, rabies induced, you know, hallucinogenic trip as he's dying, but...
Or do you think he's actually a vampire by the end?
No.
Some people actually think that.
No. You're not
one of those people.
There's nothing that happens in the movie that makes me think he's a vampire.
Well, you know what the evidence is for the people?
Please tell me.
Believe that?
Please.
Very end scene.
Yeah, but that would kill you and me, too.
No. The scene after that.
The scene after that
with the vampire woman coming back and telling him to dance for her. Jennifer Beals. Literally the scene that's Dead Space. So that's good. But there's a scene after the end of the movie. We'll get to it. It's fine. Okay. We're not going to get into it now. Anyway. So yeah, this bat flies into his apartment and he's literally like, shoo. Shoo, at the bat. Shoo. And it's like, what, man? I mean, I don't think bats speak English, so this is tough.
Well, the woman, so Jackie is the character. She freaks out and basically runs out of the apartment, and she's only wearing underwear.
Yeah, and there's a little kid creeping on her from the stair rail that I thought would come back later in the movie because they put a lot of emphasis on it, and then he's never in it again.
Nope, his mom took him away.
Yeah. So the him and he leaves the apartment with the bat still in there. And there is we see them like running through the streets. Like she gets dressed and he's kind of dressed, and I assume they're going over to her apartment or something. But they're laughing, right? And he does the most like weird fake sounding laugh.
Yeah.
It's just basically everything he does in this movie is completely batshit crazy, over the top, insane. No human would act this way, including the way he's laughing. Mm-hmm. It's just like a very distinct ha 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 ha. That's way overboard for what is actually happening.
Well, it all feels forced, right? Like this person is putting on a character,
right?
Right. Like we never get to know the actual Peter,
right?
Right. And that's so Christian Bale in American Psycho based his character off of Peter Lowe.
And what's funny is a lot of people think that Nick Cage stole this from Christian Bale. From his portrayal in American Psycho, but American Psycho came out way after this.
Way almost like a decade after.
But I think the book was out before this movie, maybe.
I mean, that may be.
But the performance, yeah. I mean, is what they're comparing, I think.
Right. No, I think what was American Psycho was 99, I think.
Yeah. Something like that. It was definitely late 90s.
Yeah.
But so yeah, he shows up to work the next day with no socks on, which they put some emphasis on, but I don't really understand why.
I think it was just supposed to show that like he didn't go back home.
And then he weirdly stares at Alva's calves or like feet when she comes in.
Yeah, I noticed that. It's the only time a shot like that happens, and I didn't really get it.
Yeah, I didn't either.
Okay.
So yeah, he's at work, and we kind of get introduced to Alva, who is, I don't know if she's just an assistant for the company that he just loves to abuse. Or if she's his assistant specifically, but he is tasking her with finding this contract. He has this guy that he represents that is wrote a short story and has gotten popular since then, but he wants a copy of his first contract to frame for his wall, essentially. And the whole file for this guy, it was the 80s. They didn't have any kind of digital organizing methods, at least not at this publisher. So they have all these things in hard files. And apparently these files are not organized in any way. And he has a ton of files. So she's got a huge amount of paperwork to try and go through. And he says he needs it ASAP, like as soon as possible.
Right.
That's what he's
talking about. So she works just like for the publishing firm, right? And we learn this later, right? She's also the newest person. So he's kind of just like dumping on the person with the least amount of tenure.
Yeah. So then we get a scene with his therapist again.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Glazer.
Which it's interesting to me because almost every character in this movie I want to know more about. And she's one of them because we get a random scene later that has no significance of her like getting ready to make love to this younger man, or maybe possibly just having made love to this younger man.
Ha cha 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 cha.
It's very like, and it doesn't have any place in the movie. It's just a really weird thing. Like, why did we need to know that? I'm assuming some of this stuff has more to do with like some of the deleted scenes, perhaps. But
right, I think so, but.
But he talks about this date with this woman and bringing her back to his apartment. And he talks about the bat. And mm-hmm. he brings up to his therapist that he was aroused by the bat. Like, meaning like he has an erection while he's fighting this bat.
Yes.
And she says something like, well, weren't you just getting ready to bang this chick? And he was like, well, yeah. And she's like, oh, don't worry about it then. It's probably just because of that. It's left over from that. And he's like, no, I was like actively aroused while fighting this bat.
Well, because he's like, well, I was doing that stuff. And then that stopped.
Yeah.
And then this new feeling came.
That was the first moment where I was like, this therapist is not like, I feel like she's not qualified. or something, because I don't think a therapist is gonna be like, oh, you we're just doing this girl, so don't worry about this arousing bat. Like, you would want to dive into why you were aroused by the bat, because he definitely thought he was aroused by the bat and not like left over from the girl. So
I would think
the therapist would try and dive into that more, but instead they just like were like, oh, no big deal, dude, just, you know, you just had a boner from the sex, it's fine.
Well, I think that ties into the end of the movie.
Yeah,
I think that's part of it.
And he actually, I'm pretty sure he actually says the words Mortal Kombat with the bat.
He does.
Which I found hilarious.
In yeah, he was locked in Mortal Kombat.
The game was not a thing. You know, it's just a funny phrase to hear from a movie that old for me. I mean, I'm sure it was a saying.
Yeah. But,
not a common one.
Spelled with a C, you know.
Right, but... okay. So at this point, I've started to realize that mirrors were really important in this movie, because mm-hmm. he has several in his apartment, and a lot of the shots were kind of like hanging on the mirrors.
Yeah.
When he walked by them, and he was always looking into them. And, you know, this got to be more important later in the movie. But yeah, he had a weird amount of mirrors in his apartment, like more than a normal person needs.
It's funny that you picked up on that. I thought he had too many chairs.
I mean, yeah. I mean, you gotta have places to sit. That's the thing. But you don't need to constantly be looking at yourself. Some people do, I guess.
I mean, I think he does. Yeah, but the mirrors are part of it, right? Because, you know, later in the movie, he starts thinking he can't see himself in the mirror, but we can see him in the mirror.
Right.
Right. So I think he's just, you know, going insane.
So I feel like maybe I missed a little bit in here, but my next note is Vampire Girl, more Nick Cage sex. So, yeah, at some point in here, Jennifer Beals shows up, and we don't really get, like, he runs into her at the club, I think, and then immediately they're in his apartment. There's, like, no in-between anything
with those two
characters.
I'm trying to think. Yeah,
I don't think there is any real context given.
There's the art gallery scene.
But that came after.
Is that after? Okay.
Yeah. He leaves to go see her again.
Right.
But yeah, so they meet at the club, and then immediately they're in like having sex in his apartment. But they don't really have, I mean, maybe they do really have sex, but she is like biting him. That's the thing, is she ends up biting him on the neck, and he's basically orgasming the whole time she's biting.
I don't think she's really there.
Probably not. I mean, that seems like, at a certain point in the movie, it's an unreliable narrator situation, and you kind of get that vibe. But did you notice the weird pasties that she wore?
I did, yeah. They were very obvious.
They probably weren't when the movie came out, but on Blu-ray and stuff, it was more obvious for sure. It does make me wonder, because the girl that he's with before that, you see nip. There's nips, you know, nips all over the place. And then,
it must have just been a contractual thing.
It is. It probably was, because I guess she was not the original person for that role. There was another actress that they didn't name, who was supposed to be that role, but they pulled out at the last minute because the person's boyfriend did not want her rolling around with Nick Cage.
Mm.
So, yeah, that's a thing. But so she was brought in late in the game, and that was probably like the one way they could get her to do this was, you know, she doesn't want to show her breasts on camera, which was fine. It was just a weird decision, you know, in the context of the movie, because we're watching a movie, we're watching the story unfold. We're not watching like the behind the scenes and the contracts. So in the sense of the movie, it was a little weird.
Yeah, I think it would have been less distracting if she had just like kept her bra on or whatever.
Yeah, that's right. Probably true.
Because I never would have given that a second glance, right? But this was just very, at least on the Blu-ray, very obvious. I think that would have been noticeable regardless, but...
Probably.
Yeah. Very weird. But I personally, based on the interaction the two of them have later, I don't think she went home with him in the real world.
Probably not. Apparently the director had a nightmare about telling Cage about the casting change. And that he stuck two needles into the director's eyes in the nightmare.
Wow.
Yeah, he was apparently really scared of Nick Cage, I'm assuming.
Scared of your lead actor, don't understand the movie you're making.
Yeah. Like,
That is concerning.
It was weird. Yeah, so we got a singing. My next one was singing Nick Cage to no one. Like, he was just singing.
Uh-huh.
By himself. Which, you know, I guess people do that. I don't know.
Yeah, he sings. A little weird. Yeah. It's fine. He's trying to be happy, right? He's feeling good. This is supposed to be like the top before his downfall, you know?
Yeah. Apparently the song that he was singing was not in the public domain. And so the production almost got sued for him singing that song and ended up paying a large sum of money by the end of it. And apparently it was because he sang it so well, so they couldn't fake that he was singing something else.
Oh,
yeah.
Jeez. That's funny. So,
yeah, then we get the art gallery, and he has a date at this art gallery with the girl that was from the first
Jackie,
where they ran into the bat.
Right.
And so he shows up to this art gallery and they're looking at art for approximately 8 seconds. And he says, I've got to go to the bathroom. And so he goes to the bathroom. Well, he goes to go to the bathroom. Also, her hat in the scene was really interesting to me. It was like, it had no top. I don't know. I know you're a hat guy, so I don't know if you were paying attention to this.
No, it was kind of like a visor that went all the way around.
Right. It just like covered the circumference of her head.
Yeah.
And like her hair stuck out the top.
Must have been a women's style.
Maybe it is. Yeah. I don't know, but I thought it was cool. Anyway.
Yeah. Because she has nice hair. So it's just kind of a cool like, accessory rather than, you know.
Yeah. I wish I could see more unique hats like that in the real world.
I'll see if I can pick some up.
Yeah, you should. I think you have a beautiful head. So I think a hat like that would do very well for you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, so he leaves. Instead of going to the bathroom, he just straight up leaves.
He ditches her.
He ditches her to go have sex with this vampire chick again.
Right.
Which is not sex so much as it is just her biting him and him orgasming during the whole thing. And I'm just kind of filling in the blanks with the orgasming. They don't, like, make it explicit that he's, you know,
no.
doing that. But he does make faces like he is. So it's just kind of assumed.
Is it in vampire lore that if a vampire were to bite the same person more than once, they would just do it in literally the exact same spot so there's no extra holes in the neck? So
there's a lot of things in this movie that I question about the lore of vampires. Okay. And I think, if I'm guessing, I'm guessing that the director didn't want to tell Nick Cage no. So he just kind of did these things and thinking they were vampire lore maybe. And everybody was just like rolling with it. And I think that may be one of them.
Okay.
But yeah, I think maybe it's just easier access. You know, you don't have to puncture as much skin. You're just like the slight little film that's there from healing.
Sure.
I don't know. That's just a guess. Anyway. Yeah, so my next one is that he was telling his therapist about being horny.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, he's very honest with his therapist. I mean, I will give him that, right? If he is there to get help, he is being open and honest with this doctor.
Yeah.
To his credit. Probably the only thing that I can say to his credit in the entire movie.
Is that he's good to his therapist. He's honest with his therapist.
He's trying to be honest with his therapist.
Yeah, and around this point, I officially like checked off the box of Nick Cage as an asshole in the movie.
Oh yeah,
I mean he was an asshole through the most of the beginning, but I thought maybe there was like going to be something that made him like his mental illness, and he was going to get better or something. But no, there's none of that.
Nope.
He smokes in this movie, so that's fun. That needs to be a bingo card thing.
That's fair. Point. Yeah, that's a good one. We'll look into adding that.
We get another scene of him at the office, and I think this is the scene where he just like has his head down and he just slowly yells Alva louder and louder and louder until he probably yells it 10 times. And by the end, he's just screaming her name.
And keep in mind, she's not that far away.
Yeah. I think maybe this isn't that scene because this is the am I getting through to you Alva scene, and in the scene I'm talking about, she does not go in there, and he comes out to her. So I don't he's harassing her about the contract because she still hasn't found it,
right?
And he tells her how important, or he tells her, I think this is when he tells her to sit there while he takes the phone call from, right, from the guy.
The dance he's going to have to do.
He has to do a dance for this customer to make sure that they understand, you know, that they're trying to get it found, but that they haven't yet, but they're working hard on it. And so he takes the phone call while she's sitting there, and the guy is like, very nice. He's like, I understand that you guys, this is an old file and you guys probably are going to have to spend some time trying to find this contract. It's really no hurry. I'm not in a hurry for it at all. And so he just basically, all Nick Cage does in this is basically acknowledge the guy and says, yes, okay, yes. And then hangs up. And at the end of it, he tells Alva that he did not have to do the dance, but that the customer wants it by the end of the week.
Or he's going to pull his contract, or whatever. He's
going to pull his contract. And he does the famous...
The point.
Know, the point, with his head down. Not, like, looking at her. Am I getting through to you, Alva? Yeah, that line. Yep. Which is great. In context, I mean, it was lovely. And there's there's a lot of scenes in this where you get context from some of the memes and things like that. And you... Even in context, it doesn't make any sense to why he's acting that way.
Yeah. He's off the rails, and it's, you don't really know why. Like, he seems to hate Alva. She hasn't done anything wrong. He's claiming that this contract is a really big deal, but the guy seems totally chill.
Yeah. Right? It seems like he's on a bit of a power trip, like he gets off a little bit on trying to control Alva. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And we do get an awkward diner scene.
Yeah.
I don't remember exactly what made it awkward. I think he just, like, is sitting there and then something happens and he just starts yelling in the middle of the diner and walks out.
There's two women sitting in the booth behind him and one of them got proposed to and he hasn't been waited on yet. They're kind of ignoring him and he just, like, flips out on everybody.
Yeah. And when he's flipping, when he flips out, he leaves and he walks back to his apartment and we get something interesting that has no explanation even by the director as to why it's there or what the point of it is. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I mean, is this the cockroach scene?
No.
Okay.
This is the mimes in front of his apartment.
Oh, the dancers.
Doing, yeah, like, what the West Side Story on loop, because when he comes out later, they're still out there doing the same scene.
The same scene. Yeah,
the director during the scene in the commentary said that he has no idea why that was in the movie.
But so he shot the movie.
He did. Yeah.
Or maybe he didn't. Like, at this point, was he actually there?
I mean, one has to wonder. This was 1988. And they did the commentary 11 years later. So maybe he was doing some illicit things that caused him to not remember a lot of this shoot. I don't know. I'm not saying that from any place. I don't know anything about this director, but the fact that he doesn't know what the movie's about, he has random shit in there that he doesn't even know why it's in the movie, makes me wonder.
I mean, maybe the cinematographer just did more, because so the cinematographer is Stefan. I'm not gonna butcher your last name if you're listening, Stefan, but he has done, like, he's still working. He was director of photography on a couple episodes of Stargirl, even. So, like, he did Blades of Glory and Matilda, a couple of Batman Returns. He was the director of photography for Batman Returns, Ryan.
Director of photography, but not the director.
No, but and Edward Scissorhand. So maybe he did a lot of the heavy lifting, and that's why our director, Robert, doesn't really know a lot of it.
Maybe. He literally said in the commentary, I don't know what this is about. I don't know what I was doing. I haven't got a clue. That was his quote from the commentary. So, yeah, there's literally just two mimes when he's walking back to his apartment doing West Side Story. Just acting and no words, obviously, because they're mimes. And he comes back out of his apartment later, and it's literally the same scene recycled. Yeah. They're not recycling the same scene with Nick Cage, but he's coming out of his apartment and the mimes are playing through the same scene that they were when he walked in, which makes me wonder, are they doing like the same 10-second scene over and over again?
Forever.
Like, for hours?
They're trapped in time.
Very weird.
They're still there, rumor has it.
My next note is knock at door before date.
Yeah, yeah, he's getting ready for a date. He's got a hot date. Well, no, he doesn't have a, so he wants to apologize to Jackie, and he gets Jackie to agree to meet him at the same club that they met at the beginning of the movie. And he's getting ready to go when there's a knock at the door.
Yes.
And it freaks him the hell out for some reason.
Yeah, he walks out and there's nobody there.
Nobody. And somehow he's already late for the date.
Yeah. So he finishes getting ready and then he leaves. And as he's getting ready to leave, he gets stopped by the vampire woman,
mm-hmm.
who seduces him back up to his apartment and bites him some more.
Right.
And
he misses the date.
Yeah.
Jackie's very upset. Writes him a big FU letter on a napkin.
Yes.
That's the last we see of Jackie, I'm pretty sure.
So yeah, we go back to his office, and this is the scene where he's slowly getting increasingly louder with the Alva yelling,
mm-hmm.
and the scene cuts to her sitting at her desk and hearing him yelling and like looking frightened, and you see him like stomping towards her, and she gets up and starts running, and he jumps up on another desk to chase her. And he chases her through this office into the women's bathroom, corners her, and she says, "I've got a gun. I will shoot you." And there's an old lady in there that's like, "What the fuck is going on? What the hell is happening?" And then she just walks away.
And she just leaves. Yeah. Clearly, Peter is deranged. He's cornered a co-worker, because she works, this is the same company, this isn't like, you know, they're strangers or anything, these people work together, right? And she knows something's wrong, calls it out to the audience, and leaves.
Yeah.
The fuck?
And you can see, it's funny, because the old lady, if you watch it, you can see her look directly into the camera on her way out, like, probably looking to the director to ask her to, like, see if she got it or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can see her look directly into the camera, and that's the take. They were like, "We're going to use that one."
That's the one. That's the take.
Yeah, that's it. And then I have napkin breakdown.
I mean, yeah. So Peter finds the napkin that Jackie wrote. You know, the "get out of my life, stay out of my life" or whatever note that she puts on his mailbox.
Mm, that's right.
And he has a bit of a breakdown over it. Cause I think like there's a shred of sanity left in him, and he knows like Jackie's this real person. She seems like a cool woman, and he keeps screwing it up because he's got the vampire lady.
Right.
Who isn't real.
Right. and so this is the part you were talking about earlier, where he goes up to his apartment and he just starts destroying everything. And so none of it was props. Like,
no, it was all real.
Real furniture. And the director said on during the commentary that he did not know how he let him do this, because they had like one take, because once everything was broken, they couldn't reset it. It was all real furniture. Anyway, yeah, if you get a chance to see this scene, when the people talk about like cage rage, I don't really love that term, because not when he's acting cagey, it's not always rage.
Mm-hmm.
But this would be probably like, if you're talking about cage rage, that's probably a good example of it. I mean, he just goes apeshit and starts.
Yeah.
And you can tell that it's not prop stuff.
Because there's a moment where he kicks a lamp and he hits the light bulb and it just it explodes. Like, there's sparks and everything. They're lucky nobody got hurt. They did break one of the two cameras that were set up, which I'm sure was not cheap. But again, like, this was not a non-union production, and the union would have had a lot of rules about that type of stuff. And so, you know, again, the question is chicken before the egg kind of thing, right? Was it a non-union film because they wanted to do this stuff, or did they get to do this stuff because it was a non-union film?
I'm guessing it was because of the budget of the film that they would have put them out of budget if they had to do things the way that, with the union.
Certainly possible. Certainly possible.
So then we get a scene with him back at his therapist, and this is the famous scene of the movie. I mean, this is the meme face is probably the most iconic still, but this scene is probably the one that if that people would know. He's talking to his therapist about this file that they're, or this contract they're looking for. And she's giving some examples about why it might not be so easy to find this file. Mm-hmm. Kind of trying to be empathetic towards Alva, essentially, you know, why he should be empathetic about it.
Oh, see, I didn't get that. I thought she was just trying to kind of get him off the hook from being like obsessed with it.
Maybe, but that in turn is what makes him more, would make him more empathetic towards Alva, I would think. He wouldn't be harassing her as much about finding this file.
I mean, that's certainly true. I just, nothing from Dr. Glazer made me think she gave a shit about any of the people.
Well, she probably doesn't have any idea about Alva. I mean, yeah it's, I just meant as a consequence of it.
Gotcha. But,
yeah, he was definitely had some like obsessive things with this contract. And this is the scene where, you know, she's talking about filing and he's goes off about how easy filing is and just do it in alphabetical order. And he starts yelling off the alphabet at her. And she goes, good job. You know how to do your alphabet.
And he does like, the whole thing.
He does the whole, goes through the whole alphabet. And he, this part of the scene reminded me of like a third grader throwing a tantrum.
Yeah.
Cause he's like, goes through the whole alphabet. And she's like, oh, you know your alphabet. And he's like, and I never misfiled anything. And he like crosses his arms and like does
little
this,
rascals
like, acting
or
like
something.
A little kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was,
and maybe that's why she treated the bat like bat arousal thing this way earlier in the movie. Maybe she has just like filed this guy away as this giant immature toddler,
which seems like something you wouldn't want to do as a therapist because your job is to try and help them through those issues. But
you'd think so, and she's a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
Which means she can prescribe medicine.
Well, he says that, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that's actually what she is.
Well, she does have doctor in her title. Like a therapist or a counselor doesn't require.
But they can be a doctor.
They can be.
Yeah. We never see her prescribe any medication or anything like that. So it's hard to say. It doesn't really matter in the end. But we did notice that too. I was watching this with my girlfriend and she said, wouldn't she be a therapist and not a psychiatrist? And I was like, I don't know. We'll never know. So world women may never know.
Whatever it is, she's making good money. That's what we do know.
That is a nice office.
Yeah.
He shows up the next day to work wearing sunglasses because the sun is getting to be too difficult for him to deal with.
Dude, these aren't even regular sunglasses. These are like what they make you wear when you get LASIK.
Yeah, they are like black sunglasses.
They're huge. Yeah.
And eventually he has Alva in his office again. And this is where we get the iconic, you know, meme face of him, like, with his face back and his eyes as big as they could possibly go.
His eyes got wider and wider. And I kept looking. I'm like, there's no way it can keep going. And it just keeps going. The memes that I've seen, I don't even think are the peak of his look in that movie.
And I'm going
to
be honest, that face was way scarier, like, to see in motion. Like,
on your TV, like real, you know, and not just, like, a GIF.
Yeah, when you see the GIF or when you see the image, it's funny. Yeah. But when you see it in the movie, it's like, what? This guy is so freaking weird, and it's a little frightening. Like, it's if I ran into somebody doing that to me on the street, I would be freaking out a little bit. It's like, look,
there are some performances in cinema, right, where you're like, man, that was just truly incredible. That actor became this character and it's scary, or it's, you know, whatever. This was so unhinged. Peter, throughout a lot of this movie, is so unhinged that I could imagine some of the cast and crew being very uneasy around him.
Yeah, I agree. And plus, if he's like doing the method thing like he was talking about, then that would be very unnerving,
right?
And you listeners may notice that we keep using words like unhinged and batshit crazy because there's really not any other words that would work for this. I mean, it is just nuts.
Between that, the scene that we're talking about, the meme face scene, between trashing the apartment, the alphabet scene, a couple scenes that happen later that we'll get to, like, I don't know another way to describe them other than this is an unhinged human being.
Yeah. And you kind of wonder if that was just like what Nick Cage was doing in this movie. I mean, I think I said earlier, he was, I feel like he was just improvising a lot of stuff. And you can kind of tell, I mean, and not that there's a problem with that, but it's just, that's why I think the plot is a little nonsensical, or trying to figure out the plot, because it seems like he just did what he was going to do. And the director just tried to get the shot of whatever he was doing.
I mean, it would be really interesting to get the actual shooting script
and compare it to what actually. Yeah, I agree.
Right. Because I would like to know how much of it was in there versus not.
Yeah. So we get more vampire sexy times. And then afterwards, it's like late at night, and his TV is on, and the old Nosferatu movie comes on.
Yeah.
And this is a big transition point in the movie, because he starts acting more and more like the actor from that movie that played Nosferatu. Mm-hmm. He starts like hunching his shoulders a lot and just, you know, acting more and more like that character. And then when he wakes up the next morning, he's looking at the mirrors, and this is another, you know, one of those things, one of those mirror themes that I mentioned earlier. But he starts touching the mirror and acting like it's burning him, which is another. You mentioned the vampire lore stuff earlier. I feel like nobody wanted to tell him that that wasn't part of vampire lore, that mirrors burn you.
The only thing I can think of, this was the 80s. Maybe the mirrors had silver backing to them.
But silver isn't a thing for vampires. It was a thing for werewolves.
It's just werewolves. It's not vampires. It's just werewolves.
Yeah, and I thought the same thing about that. Maybe he was just confusing werewolves with vampires. and if I'm wrong, then, you know, please tell us.
I think you're right. Now that I'm thinking it through. Yeah, because it's the silver bullet for the werewolves.
I'm not so familiar with werewolf or with vampire and werewolf lore that I could not, that there's a chance I'm not wrong. Or that I'm wrong. I could be wrong for sure. So like I said, if somebody listening out there,
I mean, the thing with mirrors is they're not supposed to have a reflection.
Right. That's the mirror thing for vampires.
Yeah.
And there is a scene, I think later, where he acts like he can't see himself, but the audience can clearly see him in all the mirrors.
In like, there's two different mirrors at two different angles, and we can clearly see him. It's a pretty funny scene, actually.
So then we get the cockroach scene.
Ugh.
So there's like a cockroach running around on the table, and he like picks it up and looks at it for a second, and then he eats it. And it was a live cockroach that the actor Nicolas Cage did eat twice. In fact, if you listen to the commentary,
I thought it was three times. IMDb said three times.
I think it was only two, because the director said that he was getting him back because there was a scene that. That where Nick Cage made him angry the day before, and so he made him shoot that scene twice and ended up using the first take from the scene anyway, so he had it on the first take.
Well, supposedly PETA was upset about this scene.
Yeah.
And I mean, Nick got a little defensive about it.
But they weren't upset about the pigeon later?
I mean, supposedly the pigeon's not really harmed, whereas he does eat a cockroach.
Right, that's fair. But also, this goes back to the vampire lore thing. Do vampires eat cockroaches? Is that a thing? I thought they really only drank blood, and that was their whole diet.
Well, so, okay, so in Dracula...
it's a Renfield thing. Renfield eats a cockroach, right?
Right, and he's...
But Renfield is not a vampire.
He's not, like, a full vampire, but he's been given, like, certain abilities and stuff. And so I think it's supposed to be, and we see this in some other vampire adaptations, that like while the person is still coming to grips with what they've become, they need to get like the blood from something. And so they tend to go after things that won't be missed, small things like in this case, cockroaches or birds or, you know, rats, stuff like that, instead of like people.
I feel like the amount of blood in a cockroach is probably slimmer than what would be ideal. You'd have to eat like a million cockroaches to get.
But it's his first time, right? It's his first attempt. He's still kind of figuring it out. It's not like, I think one of the keys, right, is like, it's not like you're given a manual. It's like, you know, how to be a vampire, right? So he's like figuring it out.
Sure.
And he is kind of like pathetic through the whole thing too. I mean, even the vampire lady, you know, calls that out a few times.
Yeah. So next we get a scene at his office again, where he's trying to get a hold of Alva and finds out that she has called in sick that day.
Right.
So he takes a cab all the way out. He gets her address from like the Rolodex, which if you don't know what Rolodex is, yeah, it's literally like a bunch of small index cards that you keep contact information on. It's like your phone's contact thing, essentially.
In IRL.
In paper form. So he gets her address and takes a taxi out to her house. And she's like ironing. Yeah,
without her shirt on.
Without her shirt on. And he shows up staring at her through the window.
Jesus Christ.
And she notices him. Keep in mind that earlier in this movie, not more than a few days before that, he chased her through the entire work building to the point where she threatened to murder him if he doesn't stop. So he shows up to her house and is creeping at her through the window. And, you know, she like does the boob cover up thing, even though she's wearing a bra. And he says he wants to apologize. He feels bad about the way they ended things. He wants to make it up to her. And essentially he's acting very manipulative to her because he does get her to get dressed and head back to the office. He pays for the cab to take her back. And he spent $50, which in 1988 was probably a lot of money,
on for a cab ride, there, yeah,
to get her back to the office. And on the cab ride on the way back, you know, he does a total shift back to the asshole boss. At one point, he tells her, "Shut up, bitch," and you know, it's yeah, he turns back into an asshole.
Yeah.
And she asks on the way back if she can stop in. Her brother is there at this shop, and she wants to stop in and get something from him.
She needs to give him some money.
And he just doesn't care. Like, he's like, whatever. And so they pull over, and she goes in and asks her brother for bullets for this gun that I assume he gave her.
Yeah, so she says that he gave her the gun, right? And he's like, you're not even really supposed to have it. And this whole time, it's really been just as like a show. There's no bullets. Right,
because he said that most people will just run away when you pull it out. You don't need bullets.
Right.
And so he doesn't have bullets for it. The only thing he has is blanks. And so he gives her the blanks. And as soon as this happened, I was like, okay, so she's going to end up shooting those at him. And he's going to think he's immortal because they don't do anything to him. And you know, you'll find out
surprised
later, but
were you surprised that he let her stop and go talk to her brother?
Well, at the time he's going through like something. I don't know if it was the sun, I can't remember what it was, but something was like making him feel sick.
Yeah.
And so he at that point was just trying to deal with whatever was happening to him. So not really. I don't think he really cared about anything in the moment other than trying to get through whatever's happening.
Fair enough.
And my next note is hair pulling Alva. He pulls her hair at some point. I don't know.
Oh, well, yeah. Is this right before the assault scene?
It must be, yeah.
Yeah, because he's trying to get her to shoot him. He wants her to shoot him. She's scared of him, obviously. He's trying to, you know, he continues to be very aggressive about the contract thing, talking about her staying late, all this other stuff. And he's chasing her through the building. Right, there's the big sequence where they're running down the stairs and everything.
Yeah, I think sometime in this is when he looks in the mirrors and acts like he doesn't see his reflection. Because I have that as my next note after the hair pulling. Where am I in the bathroom mirrors?
Yeah, there's a guy in the bathroom.
Yeah, and he's like he's like looking in the mirrors, going, "Where am I?" And there's like three mirrors around him, and you can clearly see him in the mirrors, but he apparently can't see himself. And he hallucinates the cab driver. So during the cab, he sees like a picture of the guy, or he's talking to the cab driver, and the cab driver shows him a picture of him and his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And he hallucinates those guys later.
Yeah.
During this whole thing with the Alva. My first note about the chase was as too late Alva chase.
too late. Oh,
because she finds the he brings her back. She's working like all night trying to find this.
Yeah.
And she finds the contract and brings it into his office. And he tells her it's too late. And he starts, this is where he gets like really fucking crazy. And he's chasing her saying it's too late, too late.
They race up a lot of stairs.
Yeah, a lot of stairs. And it shows all the stairs for some reason. And they get to like this, not a sky bridge, but like a bridge between two buildings, it seems like an area.
No, I think it was a maintenance area.
Was it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was hard to tell what it was, but it was like a fenced in area. And she said, asked if he's going to, or she says, don't rape me or something along those lines. And is pointing the gun at him. And he says like, rape you. I will shoot me. He's like encouraging her to shoot him. He's trying to say anything he can to get her to shoot him.
Now, why do you think that is? Do you think that's because he thinks he's immortal and it won't work? Or do you think that's because like he wants to die?
No, I think it's because he's like trying to see if he has that power, but it's hard to know for sure. You know, he's so unhinged in this scene. I don't really know how to interpret it. But yeah, he ends up like hitting her, biting her neck. And at this point, it's a little ambiguous as to whether he rapes her or not. It's kind of implied.
I don't think he does.
But he says he did later.
Does he?
Yeah, when he's having the talk with his therapist, he's like, oh, I raped a girl.
Oh, well, that whole thing is a hallucination, though.
But he is, sure, but, I mean, he says he did that.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
The scene is shot, I did not think it got that far.
I didn't either, but then a later scene seems to imply that he did.
Yeah. Because getting the gun, once he realized the gun was on the ground, it felt like that interrupted everything else, and he tries to kill himself, and, you know, I mean.
Yeah, so he finds the gun after it happens, and he puts it into his mouth, and he's shooting into his mouth. And I was actually pretty impressed with that scene, because it looked practical, but
yeah,
there's no way he was shooting bullets into his mouth, shooting blanks into his mouth, because that would have killed him.
Yeah,
this was way before The Crow. This was like six years before The Crow, where Brandon Lee died from a blank. But apparently Nick really wanted to shoot blanks into his mouth.
Yeah, I mean, blanks are still no joke.
They still shoot the wad and everything else out of the bullet, even if the bullet isn't, or out of the cartridge, even if the bullet isn't in there. And it still has pretty high pressure. So that would have probably killed him if he had done that. But it looked realistic. So part of me wonders how they did that. I'm sure it was just like a little spark in the end of the gun or something.
Yeah, I mean, and good sound mixing. You know. And
good sound mixing, yeah. But he doesn't just do it once, he does it twice.
Yeah.
Which made it even more impressive to me. Because, I mean, I feel like the actor in that situation would be a little intimidated by what is about to happen right in front of their face.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 80s, they were using real guns and they would just load blanks into them. So, I mean, it was probably a real gun.
Right.
But, yeah, that was an interesting scene. But after that happens, we get another famous scene from this movie where he's running through the streets yelling, I'm a vampire! I'm a vampire! And this is one of the scenes where he's just doing it next to normal pedestrians and they just don't give a shit.
Nobody cares.
This is like non-actor people just walking through the street on their, you know, having a night. And he's just running through the streets screaming that. And yeah, it's wonderful.
I don't know about wonderful, but
it was. You didn't tell me you didn't laugh at that scene.
Oh, I definitely laughed.
Yeah, okay. And this is where we find out too that he's sleeping under a tipped over couch as like a fill-in coffin.
Dude, that is so well done, because when he lifts it open.
Right, like, it's like the lid to a coffin.
And it creaks and everything like a wooden coffin does, and he lowers it back. Like the people who handled like the sound mixing and the sound editing for this movie, they actually did quite a good job.
Yeah.
In this film, you know, anytime sound is a factor, whether it's this scene or when he's trashing the apartment or the gun or whatever, it's so good. So those technical things in the movie were really well done.
Yeah. Agreed. So we now get the scene where he goes and he's convinced that he kind of looks at his teeth and realizes that he doesn't have fangs yet.
Jesus.
And so he goes into the shop where what's it called when it's like the study of the human head, where it's like they do the thing with the hand, like the lumps on your head, and they can read. It's like phrenology or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
It looks like that's the, like it's a shop for that kind of thing.
It looks like an occult shop. Ray works there or something.
Sure. That's a Ghostbusters reference for those who don't know. But this is not a shop where I would expect them to have $3.50 hidden plastic vampire teeth behind the counter.
Oh, my God.
They do have, like, really nice, like, handcrafted vampire teeth that the guy offers to Nick Cage's character. But they were, like, $98 or something. And he spent all his cash on the cab for Alva, so he only has like $4 or something like that. And the guy pulls out Nick asks him if there's anything cheaper. And so he pulls out these little like plastic fangs. And if you lived in the 80s and 90s, you've probably had some of these in your mouth at some point. They're just the cheapest shit. And the fact that it was like $3.50 for this, and that they kept it hidden behind the counter, not like on display.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I really wonder what, like, who runs the shop, because they really have their priorities in a weird space.
It's such a weird scene though, because at the same time, the way Peter is interacting with the shop guy, this is the most like normal level he is the entire movie. Yeah, I'm just looking for some vampire teeth. Oh yeah, do you have anything cheaper? You know, like, he's totally chill.
Maybe he feels like this guy gets him and isn't judging him because he works in an occult shop or something.
Maybe.
So then he puts in these plastic teeth like on a park bench.
My God.
And it looks ridiculous. I mean, you've probably seen screenshots of it, but it looks as ridiculous as you would imagine. Nick Cage with these big fake vampire teeth.
So I had never seen any of those images. So this was really new to me. This part was a surprise.
Oh, wow. So what was your take on it when he gets those teeth in?
My brain had a hard time reconciling that I was actually watching that. Because, like, when they show the first teeth, right, the porcelain ones or whatever, fiberglass, you know, they look pretty good, you know? And so I'm like, okay, yeah, whatever, that's fine. That's a way for them to continue that going. But then when he gets the plastic ones, I didn't understand what was happening anymore.
Your brain just couldn't comprehend what you were watching.
Well, because, like, this guy has to be just off his rocker, right? Because there's no way he thinks he's a real vampire, but he needs plastic teeth.
Well, his just haven't grown in yet.
Sure.
How else is he going to get blood?
Anyway,
so yeah, after he puts these teeth in on a park bench, he sees some pigeons. And so he starts chasing the pigeons around, and he finds one, and he starts chasing it around. And Nick Cage actually caught a pigeon for this. And he was very proud of that fact. But then he found out that they drugged the pigeon, which I'm surprised that PETA wasn't like, I had a problem with that. But they had drugged the pigeon to slow it down so that Nick Cage could catch it.
It must have been a safe sedative or something.
Maybe. But it was the 80s, man. That pigeon probably died and they just didn't tell anybody.
PETA would have said something about that.
Well, not if there's no way to know. Anyway. Yeah, he takes the pigeon back to his apartment, and the camera is just like following a trail of feathers in his apartment. And
too many feathers.
A lot of feathers for one pigeon. And eventually it gets to, like, you see the pigeon, parts of the pigeon carcass, and it cuts up to him with these plastic vampire teeth still in, Jesus. And like pigeon blood in his mouth. Like, he just ate this whole pigeon with the plastic his vampire bare hands. Teeth in. Yeah. I don't know.
He ate a raw pigeon.
He did, I mean, but with plastic vampire teeth in, and that just made look, it.
If the bat bite didn't give him rabies, he certainly was going to die after eating this pigeon.
Probably. And then he goes to his coffin, and we see him wake up the next day. His coffin being a couch that he lays under. It's tipped over couch, so that the cushions and the back form like a V, and he sleeps in that V. And that's like his makeshift coffin. And so when we see him wake up the next morning, he still has the fangs in.
Yep.
So he slept with them all night.
I think he wears them for the rest of the movie.
Pretty much. He takes them out at one point, but briefly. So he goes back to the club where he's been meeting all these women. And I was trying to figure out what the camera was doing at this point, because it seemed like it was just showing a bunch of boobs, like cleavage shots. Oh,
their necks. What,
yeah, it was showing necks, yeah. But it was also showing like chest and cleavage areas. So it took me a minute, because the neck was just like in the top part of the shot. It wasn't the main center focus of the shot.
Gotcha.
So it took me a minute, and same with my girlfriend, to try and figure out what this was, because it was like 20 necks that it showed, and they were basically, they were all women.
Yeah.
And so he's walking through this club, and eventually he goes upstairs, which apparently he has access to at this club. I don't know, but he goes upstairs, and there's a lone woman by herself in this like VIP area doing cocaine.
Yep.
Just sitting by herself. This club is super packed. He's having to push his way through it. And then he gets up there, and there's just one woman doing cocaine. And I imagine in the 80s, if you had cocaine at a club, you weren't doing it by yourself in general.
You know, or at the very least, there were guards watching you.
Right, something. If you're important enough to be able to go to a VIP area to do cocaine by yourself. But yeah, so he walks in there and immediately starts sexually assaulting her.
Well, wait.
It starts out seemingly consensual.
No, but like she's laughing at him. Like he's making like jokes with the teeth and everything like that, and she thinks it's hilarious until...
I don't think he's making jokes with the teeth. I think he's just like showing off the teeth, and he thinks that that's what he's doing, but she thinks he's making jokes.
Fair enough.
That's but yeah, fine. She's into it at first. And
then he grabs her.
Yeah, and he starts like they make out a little bit or whatever. And
no, it doesn't even get that far.
Oh, okay. So he's just like close to her.
Yeah, and then he grabs her breasts and she slaps him.
Right.
And
then he pushes her down and bites her neck with the plastic fangs, her neck must have been made with tissue paper, because I've had a set of those fangs and I can't imagine them going through anything.
I don't know. I mean, I guess if you bite hard enough, I don't know.
But yeah, it's he kills her. So I had casual murder checked off on at this point.
I wasn't sure if that was considered casual or not. So
I mean, it wasn't really premeditated, it didn't seem like. I mean, maybe he went there to go feed, but he didn't plan to kill this specific woman. I don't think he didn't know she was going to be up there.
Fair
he
enough.
Was just looking for somebody alone.
Yeah.
So I call it casual. I don't know. But yeah, so he bites into this woman. And, you know, there's blood everywhere, obviously, and he has it all over his face for the rest of the movie. But it is interesting, because when he walks away from her, there's a shot of her like laying on the couch, and there are puncture marks, but he also has like regular teeth mark. Like, you know, when you bite your arm and you see their teeth marks or whatever, it has like regular teeth marks, which is not something you really see in vampire movies very often. No. So I thought that was interesting. Maybe because he's unpracticed, he didn't just hit with the fangs. He like bit into the whole neck.
Well, it's because it's the plastic teeth. It's not the real teeth.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
You know, he had to bite too hard because they were plastic.
So then he goes back down to the club area and runs into Jennifer Beals' character, mm-hmm. who is playing the vampire. But in this case, he starts like acting like she's a vampire to her. And like a boyfriend shows up and is like, you know, not happy that, and she smiles and sees that she doesn't have fangs. So, I mean, at this point you're questioning whether she's manipulating him now, or like, if, you know, some people, I would assume the people that think he's actually a vampire by the end of the movie would be thinking this, because she is smiling as if like she's fucking with this guy.
No, she recognized him. Because they kind of chatted at that other club one night.
Yeah.
See, that's the, I think they chatted. They had a nice night. Nothing bad happened, right? But he didn't go home with her. So when he's like, don't you know, recognize me or whatever. At first, she doesn't recognize him, right? And then he has to say something about it. And she's like, oh, yeah, right. The other night kind of thing. I think she was just trying to be polite.
Right. Yeah. So we realized that, oh, before this, after he bites the girl, he like goes and pukes and is like laying on the ground, and he gets the hallucination of Jennifer Beals' character again. What we think is hallucination, you know, whatever. Nobody knows what's going on in this movie. So, but she's being super mean to him.
Yeah.
Calling him names and just insulting him, which I thought was interesting. But yeah, then he runs into her in the club, and he eventually gets kicked out of the club. And he just like starts walking through the streets moaning.
He's got like blood on his face, yeah. blood on his shirt. His hair looks, this might be the most ridiculous hair I've ever seen him have.
It is probably, yeah, it's up there. And he finds a pallet that's broken. And so he takes a piece of the pallet off that's sharp.
Pretty and he's large. Like
trying to kill himself with the wooden stake through the heart with the pallet, but doesn't really work.
Some people to do it.
I didn't count that as like a melee weapon because he wasn't really like trying hard to hurt himself with it.
No, I don't think that counts.
Yeah. But yeah, so then he gets to this point where gets to the street corner, like the corner of this building. And it cuts to therapy. And he's talking to his therapist.
Before you get to that, though, we do have to bring Alva's brother into the mix.
Okay, yes, that's a good point.
Right.
So, well, even though he's not really in the mix at all in this movie.
Until the very end.
We met him with the bullet thing, but then after Alva gets... Was this after the rape?
Yes.
The sexual assault?
Because her she has a big bruise on her face where she hit the ground.
She goes into like a deep depression, mm-hmm. and her family's like trying to talk to her and nobody will talk to her. And then, okay, so did you find this weird? Her and her brother seem to have a very odd relationship because she shows up in his room while he's asleep and is just like watching him sleep, essentially, or waiting for him to wake up. And he gets up and it's just like a really awkward scene.
Well, I think it's supposed to show that she doesn't want to talk to her parents. She can't like talk to them about what happened. Nobody knows what happened, right? They just know that she's depressed, locked away in her room. We don't even know that her parents know she's injured. Based on her brother's reaction, I don't think they know. And so she has made the decision to tell him, full well knowing what's likely going to be the outcome. And I think she is hesitant to do that. Probably not because she cares at all about Peter, but because she doesn't want anything to happen to her brother.
Right.
He's just sleeping. So when he wakes up, he sees a completely distraught, like broken down sister whose side of her face is all fucked up. And he's just trying to be comforting. So I think it's just a very emotional situation where, you know, they're close. They have a bond and he's the only one she trusts.
Fair enough. So yeah, it shows him like, it implies that she's going to tell him what's going on, although we don't see that. So yeah, then it shows him on this like street corner where it cuts to therapy, where he's talking to his therapist and he's like complaining about not finding anybody. And she says, well, I have the perfect person for you.
Jesus Christ.
And she likes all the same things you do and she's perfect. And she's actually my next appointment. And right at that point, like you hear like a doorbell or a knock or something like that. And he gets excited and he's like, is that her? And he's like, yeah. And she goes and opens the door and, you know, they have the same interest. They go through like, what do you like? And she says all the things that she likes. And he says, I like all those same things. And then it starts cutting out a little bit, switching between two different viewpoints. We see him completely disheveled, blood all on his face, his hair crazy, talking to himself talking to the corner of a building, essentially, where he's having this conversation with his therapist in reality, but then it keeps cutting between the hallucination and this conversation with his fake therapist or with his imaginary version of his therapist. And so the therapist is like, you know, oh, you guys are going to be perfect and, you know, you guys should go out. And so they start to leave and Peter is like, oh, well, I should tell you, I murdered a woman yesterday or I raped a woman yesterday. And she was like, oh, it's just your id getting out. No big deal. And he's like, oh, okay. But also I murdered someone. And she's like, oh, that's fine. A million people get murdered every day in New York. It's not going to be a problem. You think they're going to notice? And he's like, well, what about the police? The police will notice. And she's like, oh, don't worry. You two just get to know each other. I'll take care of the police. And during this whole scene, it's cutting between him talking to a wall, essentially. And then also where he's saying the same things and continuing the conversation, mm-hmm. but then cutting back to the imaginary therapy also. That part was a really interesting scene, I thought.
Yeah.
Because you got to straight up see his hallucination and what he's seeing versus what's actually happening, which that's the only time you really see that in the movie.
And those are a little bit tricky to shoot, right? Because you have to overshoot usually and shoot some of the dialogue that you're going to cut to intersplice with the other version of it. It's kind of a crazy scene because it begins to call into question things like, well, is his therapist real? Does he ever actually see a real therapist?
When did this become an unreliable narrator situation? You know, when did this become, what parts of this was he hallucinating?
Right. And like, you know, you've got, well, there's the payphone call where he calls her at night and you're kind of like, well, I guess that probably happened. But then you're like, well, but I mean, do we know that it happens?
Which I feel like the scene with American Psycho was like a direct ripoff of that scene, because I don't know if you remember American Psycho, but there's a scene where Patrick Bateman at the very end, like all the cops have him pinned in this room and he's calls his therapist and leaves a message. He's like, I really did kill, or maybe it was his lawyer. He calls somebody and he's like, I killed this guy and I killed this guy and I cut their head off and I did all this. And he's leaving a message for him, mm-hmm. but you don't really know whether that actually happened.
Right.
It's an unreliable narrator thing. And I feel like maybe it was an homage rather than a ripoff. I don't know. It's hard to distinguish between those two things, but yeah, I definitely got the fact that there was a lot taken from or borrowed from or inspired by this movie in that movie. And yeah. That was one of the things.
There's a lot of tone crossover between the two for sure.
So a couple of times it's cut. During this conversation, it cuts to Alva and her brother sitting in a car, and it looks to be that they're sitting across from Peter's apartment.
Right.
And they're waiting for him to show up. And so eventually he does show up, and he's like dragging this wooden piece of pallet through the streets.
Still.
And goes inside, and she's like, oh, that's him. And so he waits a couple minutes and then goes inside. Tells her to wait in the car and goes inside, finds Peter underneath the couch and he lifts the couch off of him and picks up the piece of wood and puts it to his, or no, Nick Cage puts that to his chest. Doesn't he put it to his own chest?
Yeah. Cause the brother, he has like a tire iron.
Yeah. Classic 80s murder weapon.
Yeah.
And so
but you gotta imagine what's like going through his head when he enters this trashed apartment and this dude's like sleeping under a couch. Like, right. What the fuck?
And so basically the piece of pallet is already up to Nick Cage's chest. So all he has to do is like lean on it a little bit and it kills Nick Cage. Nick Cage dies at the end.
Slowly pushes it in.
Yeah. And so he dies and it cuts to the end of the movie. And right after that, there's a scene. This is the one I was trying to reference to Derek that he apparently doesn't remember.
No, I remember. But
Jennifer Beals' character shows up and says something like, dream of me, dream of me.
Yeah, I think that's just like his hallucination in the throes of death. Like he is dying. And
that seems like a reasonable assumption. But I can also see where, you know, somebody might think something differently than that. It's all of this is open to interpretation.
Sure, but if you think he's a vampire, the stake to the chest thing is like the number one way to kill a vampire.
I mean, that's true too, yeah.
So that actually doesn't support.
But it's more like, it's not even on his heart. That's what I found funny about it, is it's like in his, like just below his sternum, like in a solar plexus.
It like goes through his lung or whatever.
Yeah, which if it was a vampire, it wouldn't kill him.
I guess. I don't know.
But yeah,
it's a pretty thick piece of wood. I don't know.
That's the movie.
Oh my God.
It was.
Oh my God.
Something special. This podcast has gone long because there's a lot to talk about in this movie, but we'll get through this rating here.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right. So those who are new to the show, we have our Cage-O-Meter. We rate all of our movies on a scale of 0 through 20, 0 low, 20 high. We do overall quality. So 20 being the greatest movie ever. And then overall caginess. And so
is just that indescribable quality that Cage brings to a movie that no other actor can really bring. And I think we can both say for this movie, I think that this is a 20.
On caginess?
Yeah, I don't think this is going to be, there's going to be another movie that is anywhere. I mean, even the ones that we've rated really highly, I feel like we probably rated too high. If this is the top, but I'm not going to go back and change those. But yes, I think this is a 20, and I don't think anything is going to get even close to it, really.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. I think we both agree that caginess is a 20. That's goes without saying. And we don't really have a whole lot of competition. I'm just kind of looking, and I think the high before that was like overall caginess. I mean, we're looking at Mandy.
Which is reasonable. That's probably the closest one we've watched.
Mandy was a 16.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, a 16 and a half. And then Unbearable Weight was a 16.
Yeah, and I think that is probably maybe we'll get a little closer on some of his other roles, but I feel like that's I don't know. I can't imagine any movie getting higher than maybe a 17 or an 18.
Yep.
If this movie is the 20. I mean, that's how far away, how far out it is compared to all these other movies. So then we have to come up with our quality rating.
And this one's a lot harder.
It is. I had the same thought because it's a lot like, you know, like Evil Dead, right? It's critically, it's maybe not the best movie, or like Army of Darkness is maybe not like objectively the best movie, but because of how bad it is, it adds a layer of appeal to it that makes it, you know, rate higher for me. And that's tough to judge.
And I agree, because a lot of the movies that we've rated low from a quality standpoint are movies that are just not a joy to watch. They were not fun. They were a bit of a slog. Movies like Rage or Inconceivable, for example.
Yeah, they're just bad.
Zondali. These are just bad movies. Prisoners of the Ghostland. It's hard for me to want to rate it as low as those. Right? Like, right. I mean, we gave Left Behind, you gave it a 5, and I gave it a 4 for Left Behind. So it was a 4.5. I would watch this over Left Behind.
I would watch this over a ton of the movies.
Right?
Even once we've rated like 10 or 11, I'd probably rather watch this one again.
Fair enough. So
which
like,
makes it hard.
It does. Right? It makes this really difficult. And so I'm trying to be as fair as possible. And I think really the only way to be fair is to maybe give it like an 8.
I was thinking an 8 too, which it makes me a little sad because, like I said, I would rather watch this than a lot of the other movies that we've rated higher. But it's just like judging the actual quality of the movie is there was the plot was a mess, you know, the a lot of things just didn't make any sense. And the reason it's enjoyable is mostly because of the caginess of it, not mm-hmm. because it's a good movie.
Well, there are some technical things that give it a knock too. Like the audio quality is really, the dialogue audio is really terrible.
Yeah.
But when I turned on the closed captioning, it was riddled with errors. Tons of typos, duplicate letters, words missing, typos. Like it was just like, there's a lot of technical problems with the movie too, where they could have at least salvaged some
stuff.
You
also said that the sound design was above average.
That's true when it came to the sound mixing of like special effect type stuff. That's true.
So you're saying an 8.
So I'm saying an 8.
Yeah, I was thinking like an 8 or a 9. So I think that's a fair place for it.
Okay. So an 8 on quality and a 20 on caginess. So that does put it, of course, in our top left quadrant of movies.
Yeah, so it's probably in a weird spot.
Yeah, I mean, there's not too much there. There's, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So this is the 6th movie in that quadrant.
But it's often, it's like, it's a ways from all those other movies, I feel like.
Yeah.
Because of the caginess being so high.
If you were to split that quadrant into quadrants, it's alone.
Yeah.
It's the, you know what I mean? So, right. Kind of, again, it's a very strange situation. And then before... We'll have to. We need a new Cageometer out there for people to see. We'll go over that. Maybe we reach 50 episodes. We can do a quick little recap of where some of the heavy hitters landed.
Sure.
But we need to decide what movie is going to join our Wheel O Cage and replace Vampire's Kiss. And so the movie that will be joining our wheel is Never on a Tuesday. Which he is actually uncredited.
Okay.
So
it's got to be a small role.
It's probably a small role. It on my list, it was directly after Vampire's Kiss, so roughly that age, give or take.
Interesting.
For what that is worth. So there you go. That's joining the wheel. To find out what Nicolas Cage movie we're going to talk about next time on the show, you'll have to watch our next Wheel O' Cage spin. You can do that, of course, at comingofcage.com, on all of our social media apps at Coming of Cage, or on our YouTube channel, which is at Dorico Studios, which is our production company there. Ryan, anything else for Vampire's Kiss? Was it everything you hoped for?
It was a lot, yes. I mean, I don't really know what to say about it.
Fair enough. Yeah, it was out there. If you haven't seen it, this is the easiest time to watch it, because there is a Blu-ray that's readily available to purchase.
For now.
Which was not, well, 2 years ago, the movie was extremely difficult to find. You basically needed a Laserdisc for a legitimate copy. So, you know, go watch it. Go check out Vampire's Kiss and then play with some GIFs and memes. But that's it for us this week. We are the Coming of Cage podcast. I'm Derek. That's Ryan.
Am I getting through to you, listener?